Hey everyone, if you love listening to Curbsiders and want to enhance the experience, then now is a great time to join the Curbsiders Patreon with new annual memberships where you can save 10% off the monthly rate. You'll have the option to hear all the episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes. You can sign up at patreon.com/curbsiders. This is a great way to use that CME money that's probably burning a hole in your pocket, plus support the show so we can keep bringing you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, mini-series like Teach and Addiction Medicine, our Digest newsletter, and of course, expand our video content. So join the Cashlack family today at patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts. It should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Kat, it's been a while since we've chatted. I want an update.
I know. Where have you been?
I know. I want to know how your are your tomatoes doing? Really, that's the burning question that you mentioned.
So glad that you asked. Yeah, the tulips died, but that's fine. It's later in the season. Tomatoes, you know, I think that I'll get a few. It's really hard to say. It's been an exciting project.
And I feel like
a few months over here.
The tulips will come back, right? They're like very.
They're perennials. I've learned.
Yeah. And on that note, welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our mini series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Kat Mullins. And on today's episode, we're really excited to chat with everybody about racism and inequities in addiction medicine with the amazing Dr. Myra Mathis. But before we get started with that, Kat, will you remind everybody what we do on the show?
Absolutely. So we are the addiction medicine podcast that uses expert interviews to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. And reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. By listening to this episode and completing the CME, this can count toward the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorder education.
And as always, a very special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Med miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction med faculty and trainees, and they are dedicated to training and supporting the next generation of academic addiction med leaders. Whether you're an addiction med physician preparing for the ABPM board exam or a physician in practice, just looking to learn more about the addiction medicine field, ACAM offers several self-study products that would help meet your needs. The professional practice bundle includes access to 86 self-assessment modules that provide CME, as well as 46 didactic lecture recordings. ACAM's board prep bundle also offers access to the 46 didactic lecture recordings, along with a nearly 200-item question bank and its addiction e-practice test. So to learn more about these and other product offerings, as well as membership opportunities, be sure to visit acam.org.
So we have a fantastic conversation tonight with our guest, Dr. Myra Mathis. Dr. Mathis is faculty member and board-certified general adult and addiction psychiatrist at the University of Rochester, Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Mathis is the medical director for Strong Recovery, the University of Rochester Medicine's outpatient addiction psychiatry service, which includes an opioid treatment program, adolescent and young adult clinic, and SUDPC, this stands for Substance Use Disorder in Primary Care. And this is a mobile consultation team that addresses unmet substance use disorder treatment needs in the community around Rochester and the primary care network. Dr. Mathis is also the program director for the University of Rochester Medicine's Addiction Psychiatry Fellowship Program. Nationally, she serves as the co-chair for the Opioid Response Network's Black Communities Workgroup. Her academic interests include racial health equity and social justice in psychiatry and addiction, as well as medical education for students, residents, and fellows in the treatment of substance use disorders.
Dr. Mathis teaches us a ton this episode. Honestly, I think she gave a really great overview on how the war on drugs continues to impact communities of color to this day, as well as I love that she gave us some really practical tips that we as clinicians can do on a daily basis to really help decrease inequities in addiction treatment.
And she talked about these both on the clinic level and on her own patient panels. So particularly when it comes to doses of methadone and buprenorphine, why it matters, who has access, and how both of these substances have been racialized in the United States in particular.
And why don't we jump in? Hi, Myra. It's so great to have you on the show today. And we really want our audience to get to know you a little bit better. Is it okay if you give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Yeah, sure. Myra Mathis. I am an addiction psychiatrist and general adult psychiatrist. I am a mom, mom and bonus mom, ages ranging from 2 to 18. I am a wife. I enjoy singing in my free time and try not to get stuck when Netflix says, do you want to continue or do you want to stop? But with a 2-year-old in the house, my nights are my only free time to watch whatever I want.
That deeply resonates with me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad I'm not the only one getting that message. And what about addiction medicine? So what are your favorite aspects of working in the field of addiction psychiatry?
Yeah. So in addiction medicine and addiction psychiatry, my favorite things are, first, I love the patients. I love being able to be a part of folks' stories. I think that's why I also like psychiatry and seeing how folks evolve along their journey. I like meeting folks where they're at and seeing how we can make small steps towards improvement together. And I also like that there is this intersection between policy and practice in addiction medicine. It can be really frustrating, but there's also a great opportunity for advocacy.
I think that's a great segue into today's topic, too. Typically, we'd start with a case here, but we're going to do things a little differently. So we're going to talk about some of the history of racism in U.S. drug policies, as well as inequities in addiction treatment for BIPOC populations. And we're defining that here as Black, Indigenous, people of color. So for this topic, I think it would help to start with some really basic definitions. So Myra, can you define race and racism for us?
Yes. So race is a social construct that really assigns value and importance to individuals by the color of their skin. It's really important that we all remember that race has no biological or genetic underpinning. It's really just about how someone looks and where fairer or lighter skin has been valued and esteemed as better or more important than darker skin. And this leads to the system of racism that then assigns a sort of creates a structural hierarchy around that concept of race. And so racism is first and foremost a system that sort of really pervades a lot of our society, particularly in America, but racism is found across the globe. And we think about the ways in which, based on this hierarchy and value placed on skin color, certain individuals then receive privileges that and others are disadvantaged. And the system that creates this sets of privilege and disadvantage can be seen in housing policy, can be seen in things like generational wealth, and can also be seen through education. So really, the system of racism it overcasts all of the other systems within American society, including healthcare.
And we know that there are definitely racial inequities and disparities in the way that individuals who use substances have been treated in the U.S. So can you tell us a little bit more about some U.S. policies that really have negatively, unfortunately, impacted BIPOC people in the U.S. and the effects that they may still be having today?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the way racism shows up in addiction policy is really interesting and really painful and a sad part of our history. So we've seen this in a lot of ways through what's been known as the war on drugs, what many would consider a war on drug users, and that particular drug users were impacted by these policies more than others. Really, the war on drugs created an enforcement infrastructure that was meant to try and find or identify individuals who are distributing large amounts of illegal substances that could be causing harm to various neighborhoods, people groups, and individuals. What this did was create an infrastructure that sort of expanded law enforcement, really expanded policing systems. And those policing systems were primarily based in poorer communities. And because of the system of racism, individuals from Black and Indigenous backgrounds are overrepresented in areas of poverty. And so these policing systems in areas of poverty, primarily with people of color, Black individuals and Hispanic individuals or Latinx people in particular, were then sort of identified as the folks who are engaging in this criminal activity at higher rates. Whether that is true or not, actually, we know that's not true. However, the systems that were created concentrated that enforcement in those communities, leading to a part of what fueled mass incarceration and many of the disparities that we see in our criminal legal system in terms of the rates of incarceration for Black and Latinx individuals, and particularly men. In one example, of course, of a law that was sort of deployed in this process, was the law that established our crack cocaine, I use that in quotes, sentencing disparity, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, where there was a 5-year mandatory minimum for a federal prison sentence for the possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine compared to 500 grams of powder cocaine. And so this led to what many will recognize as this 100-to-1 disparity in terms of the amount of substance that someone was in possession of. So for individuals in urban areas that were a predominantly Black and Latinx communities, possession of very small amounts of crack cocaine then led to much higher prison sentences, and of course is a major contributing factor to this disparity as it relates to the criminal legal system.
It's just such a crazy, that 5 to 500 number when it's exactly the same chemical substance is just so wild.
It is wild. And I know we'll talk about this a little bit more, but so much of this has to do with how substances are portrayed in the media and in society, and then what leads to sort of a public outrage, which translates to a political response. And this political response had to do with the perception in the media of what crack cocaine, in quotes, which is really freebase cocaine, just another formulation of the same compound, what that supposedly did to someone's behavior, as if intoxication with crack cocaine looked any different than intoxication with powder cocaine.
It's so frustrating. It's like, this is not fair, you know, just when you hear those numbers and say them out loud. And is this sentencing still in place right now, this disparity?
So thankfully, we've made some progress, right? So in 2010, with the Fair Sentencing Act, this was reduced from 100-to-1 to 18-to-1. I mean, it took us almost 40 years to get to this point. And when we think about those 40 years, it's important to also keep in mind the hundreds of thousands of individuals who were then sentenced under these laws, the amount of years of time lost from their lives, their communities, what potential sort of contribution they could have made to their families and their communities, all of that was lost over the course of almost 40 years. So we're grateful that this has changed. It's no longer in effect, that the disparity has been eliminated. But we still need to keep in mind what restorative justice looks like for these communities that were devastated by these policies.
And to your point earlier about this interesting intersection between sort of like policy and health, particularly within addiction, you know, we've really seen the rise of fentanyl in the last couple of years. Are you worried that history may repeat itself? Are there things on the horizon that you sort of have some concerns about regarding this and some different state regulations that may be trying to pop up?
Yeah, this is a huge area of concern. And again, it does come back to sort of what public outrage kind of looks like, and how substance use, how individuals who sell drugs, how they're portrayed in the media. It's important to note that the majority of individuals who are selling low amounts of drugs are oftentimes using those same substances, and so they're in need of treatment. And we have this dichotomy between individuals who need care and need protecting versus the individuals who are seen as sort of bad and who need to be criminalized, when there is quite a bit of overlap between those two groups of people, and that it's not really a monolith. And unfortunately, certainly we need to, let's say it this way, certainly we need to take action when it comes to death toll that we are seeing as it relates to drug overdoses due to fentanyl. We do need to take action. But whether or not action looks like homicide charges for an individual who sold fentanyl, I have serious questions about that. And I'm very concerned about how these laws will be weaponized against certain communities, and particularly against people of color, Black individuals, Latinx individuals, and even within our indigenous communities. There is still a tremendous amount of bias, unfortunately, in our criminal legal system. And there are certain individuals who are seen as the ones taking a life, and others who are seen as needing to be saved.
And it sounds like you're really, you know, you're getting at kind of how criminalization has been this tool to manage certain groups of people in this policing system. And I'm curious where we stand right now, knowing there has been some positive change with mass incarceration and downstream effects, what that looks like.
Yeah, so that's true. There really has been some positive change as it relates to mass incarceration. There has been a decrease in the steep of in the sort of the depth of the disparity in terms of, you know, what we would have said about 10 to 15 years ago, where one in three Black men were incarcerated in America. We're starting to slowly see that number decrease. As that is changing, right, there are some, we do need to keep in mind that this is not happening uniformly across the country, that it is happening in certain states and certain areas. We've had changes at a federal level, but again, this only sort of imprisonment and incarceration in federal system accounts for just a fraction of the overall incarcerated population. The majority of individuals are incarcerated in state prisons. And so these state level laws govern what that prison population looks like. So we're seeing some progress, but we need to be mindful of places where things still look as bad as they did 15 or so years ago. Because again, these are state level policies, and all the changes that may be happening at a federal level, or even in some places that are considered progressive states, are not happening across the country.
And thinking back, as you alluded to, sort of like the root cause of some of this, or some things that have been contributing to the public's perception, is that we know, honestly, that mind-altering substances, it's been a part of human history for thousands of years, right? These are not This is not a new concept, but in the U.S., substance use has often been associated with groups of marginalized or stigmatized individuals. How do you feel like media portrayals factor into the demonizing versus humanizing of certain groups of people?
It's another really important question and something that we really struggle with trying to sort of find the right balance in this country. I would say that in addiction medicine and addiction psychiatry in general, we have made some progress in terms of stigmatizing language in the media. Some progress, but there's still more work to be done. Where we have journalists who are less likely to refer to patients or individuals as a drug addict, where we are using more person-first language, a person with a substance use disorder, that these changes are happening. Again, not uniformly, not everywhere in the country, but there's been some progress. When more stigmatizing or demonizing language is used, historically, it has been used to portray people of color, in particular Black men with a substance use disorder. So there were many news articles showing a Black man with sort of a white substance around his lips, eyes very sort of oversized for his face, very large, pupils very large, and with this grimacing facial expression. And this was supposed to depict a Black man who was intoxicated with cocaine. And that grimacing facial expression was meant to provoke fear, to associate this individual using a substance with violence. And that because an individual using a substance was associated with violence in that medial portrayal, it seemed to justify these laws that created the 100-to-1 disparity, sentencing disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. As time has progressed, and with the sort of emergence of what we currently call the opioid epidemic, which is really right now an overdose epidemic, the media portrayals have changed and softened. And there are more narratives about a person's background and their family and who they're connected to. And the stories around substance use don't focus solely on the substance or solely on the behaviors of a person when they're intoxicated. They're focusing more on the life trajectory of an individual. They're focusing more on other parts of their sphere. And this is also because what has been called the opioid epidemic was seen as a crisis affecting white communities. So there's a hope for people of color, for Black communities, for Latinx communities, that same sense of compassion and that same humanizing perspective will be offered to all individuals who are diagnosed with a substance use disorder, that we have a humanizing approach for all people who use drugs.
And then where do we stand right now and who can actually get treated once somebody has a substance use disorder or is trying to find, you know, a clinician?
Yeah. Great question. So in terms of treatment, and particularly for individuals from Black and Latinx communities, I would say treatment for substance use disorder looks a lot like it does for other chronic health conditions in this one sense, that individuals are presenting later and with more severe course of illness, right? Because similar to how individuals from Black communities and other communities of color have experienced discrimination in healthcare systems, right? This is sort of amplified when you have a substance use disorder, because no one wants to go to their doctor and not only experience the stigma of having a substance use disorder, but also then the racialized stigma and discrimination as a person with a substance use disorder for fear that they will be targeted in a more direct way. Like, am I going to have more drug screenings? Are people going to look down on me? Are you going to take care of my other health needs if you find out that I have a substance use disorder? So there is a hesitation on individuals from the community itself to present for care, but then also the reality-based experiences that they've had when they do present for care. When we're finally seeing a doctor about a variety of chronic health conditions, including substance use disorder, our disease is more severe. It's been going on for longer, and we're having more consequences. So what that looks like in terms of treatment, Black individuals specifically with opioid use disorder, when they're presenting to emergency rooms currently, right now, in our current state of affairs, are less likely to receive medications for opioid use disorder than white individuals. And this is for individuals presenting in withdrawal for opioid use disorder. So not just someone coming for another health condition, but someone actually coming seeking assistance for opioid use disorder, less likely to be prescribed medications to treat that condition. When we look at overdose rates in this country, certainly a lot of attention has been focused on rural white communities and suburban communities as it relates to the opioid and overdose crisis. But we are seeing data emerge year after year, starting between 2019 and 2020, but really some data as early as 2015 showing that the rates of overdose deaths in Black communities is outpacing that of white communities. And in particular for Black and Indigenous communities, we have the highest rates of overdose deaths in the United States at this time. So really, our communities are experiencing a crisis. So we need that same robust, compassionate response if we are going to stem the tide of overdose deaths in Black and Indigenous communities as well.
I think the way that whiteness operates there is so interesting too. And I'm speaking to this as a white woman, but you were talking before about kind of the face of these epidemics, but the way that the opioid epidemic, once people were getting oxycodone prescription, this was now suddenly a white problem. And you use the word suburban and how this is just coded language for whiteness. I just think it's a really fascinating thing that's happening again, kind of with treatment for substance use disorders and who gets medication.
I couldn't have said it better. Yes, whiteness is always present. And when we talk about racism, we cannot talk about it without identifying whiteness. We can't talk about it without identifying a parallel system of racism is white supremacy. Those two things are part and parcel of the same process. And so whiteness as a form of privilege then means access to treatment, access to care, and more compassionate portrayals in the media.
And how can clinicians really advocate to help improve these systems? We want to get better access to treatment for all and decreasing some of these disparities that we're seeing.
Yeah, great question. So one thing that addiction physicians and specialists can do, speaking of sort of the power of the narrative and how a narrative related to the opioid epidemic and overprescribing of pain medications has been seen as a white problem. The solutions and the response to that has also included suing big pharma, states receiving large settlements to account for the costs of the opioid epidemic. And we need to be at the table to ensure that there is a racial justice lens applied to the distribution of these funds. How are these funds being used to support communities of color in accessing treatment? How are these funds being used to supplement the cost of medications in states where there hasn't been Medicaid expansion and individuals struggle to pay for those medications? We want to be creative about how we're utilizing those funds. And that's one way that we can leverage our influence to advocate for the treatment needs of communities of color. That's on a policy level. And then there are so many ways that we advocate for our patients on a day-to-day when we're in the office. Some of that looks like your patient is late after taking two buses, trying to get to their appointment, and you wait before you no-show them. I know that's tough in a busy clinic day when you've got back to back to back to back to back patients. But taking this sort of structural competency approach where we think about the social determinants of health and how they're playing a role in someone's ability to access their healthcare, and that we ask our nursing staff or we collaborate with our nurses and we collaborate with our techs to say, hey, I'm going to pull this person in because they got here early, but so-and-so is coming a little late and we're going to fit them in too. Let's try and make this work. So it's from those smaller conversations in our clinic to those what can feel like larger scale conversations in our legislative bodies.
And Myra, I'm curious how harm reduction fits into all of that. I mean, we've spoken about it on previous episodes, but how does that fit in?
Yeah. Love it. Yes. So harm reduction is huge when we're thinking about communities that have been so negatively impacted by criminalization. That harm reduction as an approach is both sort of practically, how can we make a plan that feels safe and workable for you? As the patient. So what does that look like? Is it changing the route of your use? Is it using over a longer period of time? Is it talking about not mixing substances together when you are using? Harm reduction includes all of those practical aspects, but it is also this approach that says, wherever you're at in your like journey, wherever you're at in terms of your relationship with substance use, like, I'm just here to support you as your physician, and I want you to be as healthy as possible. And I want you to be as healthy as possible for as long as possible. And so if there are risks in using substances that could be very serious or dangerous, how can we minimize those risks? This non-judgmental and really open approach is critical for engaging communities that have been not only stigmatized, but racially discriminated against. And the mix of that stigma and that racial discrimination compounds itself that makes folks feel like they're going to be looked down on or they're going to be dismissed. So we can't have a conversation without it.
I love your tips of sort of working towards combating this in sort of the big and small ways, not overlooking these harm reduction approaches, being non-judgmental, making sure people feel comfortable and safe to come back to us, even if maybe abstinence isn't their goal, as well as really, you know, taking our patients' social determinants of health into consideration and adapting that actively as much as we can in the clinic, all the way to advocating, right, to use some of these opioid settlement funds intentionally. I think that's a great list.
And I'm curious about treatment, you know, going back to opioid use disorder, for instance, if we think about methadone versus buprenorphine, what are some of the patterns there?
So great question. And this was on my mind earlier, so I'm glad we've come back to it. So when methadone clinics or opioid treatment programs were established, it's really interesting because they were established in parallel with what we consider the start of the war on drugs, right? So within the same set of laws, we have the establishment of some form of treatment for opioid use disorder, right? But it's connected to this expansion of law enforcement and targeting of communities of color as it relates to over-policing. And so then the method of treatment that is provided reflects, unfortunately, some of these similar sort of carceral ideas where there is this tight regulation. It's the most regulated medication in the United States. Certainly, SAMHSA has relaxed some of those regulations in the last year, where folks starting out can receive up to a week's worth of methadone, whereas in the past, it would take them almost 6 months to get two or three bottles out of the week. So some progress there. So many physicians have no experience prescribing it for opioid use disorder because it can only be done in certain settings. And this has meant of course, with the development of methadone clinics, primarily in neighborhoods often impacted by poverty, because individuals with wealth and privilege did not want, quote unquote, those people near them. And so the concentration of methadone clinics ended up being placed in neighborhoods that essentially had divestment of other types of financial resources. And what that translates to is that there were more people of color living in those communities where methadone clinics were often established. And so we do see that individuals with opioid use disorder who receive medications for opioid use disorder, if they are Black and Latinx, they are more likely to then be prescribed methadone than they are to be prescribed buprenorphine. However, this idea that we had to keep folks sort of confined to a certain space and location in order to receive their medication certainly reflects the perception that we had of who the opioid users were at that time. So if we think about the more recent opioid epidemic, buprenorphine was actually developed directly in response to that when opioid use disorder was seen more as a white rural and white suburban problem. And the data shows us that buprenorphine is accessed more and prescribed at higher rates in white communities than it is in communities of color, and particularly for Black and Latinx individuals. In buprenorphine, you go into your doctor's office, you get a script, and you walk out. And you can have up to 30 days supply of that medication as compared to needing to stand in line at early mornings to receive a dose and maybe two or three of methadone. There is some legislation looking at liberalizing those regulations for methadone, but and the hope is that individuals will have better access to their medication in the future.
So maybe some changes in the upcoming years to let everyone know about.
Yes. I hope hopefully. We're here for these changes to have the chance to prescribe and practice methadone in a very different way.
Yeah.
Yes. Office-based methadone. Not quite here yet, but hopefully we can dream the dream.
Need a little background research.
We can dream. I really like there was a rush of excitement when you said that. I just felt like, wow, it could really be.
So how about the concept of anti-racism? I wonder if you could speak to what that looks like. What is this as a framework?
That is a wonderful question. So first, it's important to realize that there is no such thing as race neutral. Like in America, where we have a system that is based on race and has assigned this preferential hierarchy, race neutral essentially sort of maintains status quo. And that's why anti-racism is so important, because it means that we are actively working towards restructuring that system and bringing equity and balance to that system. So it requires action. It requires intentionality. That means we're identifying disparities, like in our own prescribing practice. It's good to just do an audit of who your patients are, who you're prescribing what to, what are the average doses, for example, for patients of different racial backgrounds? And are we seeing someone as needing a higher dose of something or a lower dose of something based on how they present to us? And we don't realize that until we actually do an audit of ourselves, some quality improvement. That is an aspect of anti-racism, where we're taking action to make sure that our practices are not perpetuating disparities.
That is so actionable, and I have never thought about it, and I am going to do that. Thank you for that point.
Yeah.
Yes. Look at naloxone scripts and doses. I think that's a great idea.
Yes. So a concept that goes hand in hand with anti-racism is cultural humility. And cultural humility is really just the concept that we recognize that our patients are the expert at their lives. I think in addiction medicine and in addiction psychiatry, we're doing better at that as we embrace more of a harm reduction approach to our patients in general, and individuals with substance use and individuals who use drugs in general. This is particularly important for individuals from minoritized backgrounds, because it means that we're just recognizing that we don't know everything about what it is to live in their life, in their shoes, in their skin, and we need to follow their lead.
That's a great point, just working on being as non-judgmental, as open as possible, and really working towards the goal of like meeting someone where they're at. Because as you said, like, we don't really fully understand what another person's experiences have been. So it's important to stay open and listen truly as much as we can.
And I'm curious if you could give us some main take-home points for our listeners, knowing we're reaching the end of our time here.
Yeah. Well, first, let me say it's been great hanging out with you. I've really just enjoyed the conversation. Things to be mindful of. We all know the U.S. has a really unfortunate and sad, painful history as it relates to race and racism. And this has particular salience in addiction due to the war on drugs and racialized drug policy. So once you're an addiction physician, you are in the work of anti-racism already. You've chosen it because you've chosen a place and a field that has this overlay of additional racialized policies that impact the way our patients engage in care and exist in the world. So if you're an addiction physician, congratulations, you've also signed up to be in the work of anti-racism in medicine. Next point, we do need to be mindful of a racial justice lens in our policy advocacy work. And so when we're thinking about advocating for any particular policy change in addiction, we have to ask ourselves this next question of, how is it going to impact the individuals who are most marginalized within our patient populations and groups? And that includes marginalization by race, by gender, and other, by ability and other status. And if you don't know what that could be, talk to patients and actually hear from them what's getting in the way of them being able to achieve the health status that they want. This might include, this can also include having peers on your team to help you inform what those policy points need to be. So if you're an addiction physician, you're engaged in anti-racism in medicine, and when we're advocating for policy change, we also need to have a racial equity lens for all policies that we're putting forward. In your clinic, harm reduction is key, that non-judgmental stance, and being mindful of how you're implementing anti-racist practice on a day-to-day. Is that your quality improvement project? Is that the signage in your office? Like, who are we inviting? What are the pictures portraying? Do we have happy Black families and happy Hispanic families and happy LGBTQ families present in our offices to let folks know that this space exists for them too? All of these things, from policy level on down to our one-on-one patient interactions, make a difference in terms of how we can stem the tide of the disparities that are being faced by communities of color.
And do you have anything you would like to plug? It can be anything. It can be addiction-related, non-addiction-related.
A couple of things. First is Kamara Jones' allegory, The Gardener's Tale. If you haven't heard of that yet, like, that's just race and racism in medicine 101. So you should definitely just make sure you've read that to understand how this system impacts every aspect of our lives.
And we will link to it in the show notes.
And if you want to just hear about some cutting edge work that's racial equity focused and addiction, the You have to know about Dr. Ayanna Jordan and what she's doing with the Imani Breakthrough Project. She's talked about this at a few conferences, and there are some preliminary publications, but the work is ongoing. So it's just one of those things you need to know. And it provides some great tips for folks who are not working in this space.
Great. We'll be sure to get those links out to folks. Thank you so much for spending your Friday afternoon with us.
Yeah, Myra, this has been amazing. Thank you.
Thanks, Kat. Thanks, Carolyn. Really enjoyed being with you.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org. A special thanks to our team for this episode, including our editor, Dr. Kento Sonoda, and our whole team. The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at PodPaste.
And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Dr. Kat Mullins. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you some addiction medicine pearls.